The following is an encore episode of Hour 1 of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. That music you probably know is Boston's famous Peace of Mind, and we are talking mind games today. We're talking all about the mind. My guest this morning is Matthew Alper, who wrote a fascinating book about the mind and the spiritual component that he feels he discovered within it. However, the thing is that Matthew may have discovered that, but he doesn't believe in God. So it's going to be a very interesting discussion. He's a natural skeptic and atheist, whereas I'm coming from the other side of the aisle. So this is going to be an interesting conversation coming up in the next segment. Now, talking of mind and mind games, the other thing that struck me today, I trawl the internet every morning for some unusual stories or interesting stories or things that may just be of interest. Now, I'm not trying to do LA Catholic Morning Hour 2. You already get all the proper news in that show and all the good news and some of the not so good news. But sometimes things just pop out and I feel as if I have to bring them to your attention. And I couldn't believe my ears this morning when I heard on the radio the announcement that Edinburgh, yes, Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland, had become this kind of vegan capital of Europe. It is the first European capital to take meat off the menu in schools, hospitals, old people's homes, nursing homes, anything run by Edinburgh Council, they have taken meat out of the equation. Now, you might say, well, so what? Well, I mean, the timing couldn't be more apt or not, as the case may be, because next week Scotland celebrates Burns Night. Now, Burns Night, for anybody who doesn't know, is a great Scottish quiz occasion which celebrates the life and poetry of the poet Robert Burns, who lived, he died in 1796, so he lived in the 18th century. And he is probably Scotland's most famous poet, and My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose, all that sort of stuff, all good stuff. Anyway, they have basically a great night out in his honour on January 25th. And the centrepiece of that great feast has always been haggis. Now, I know what you're going to ask, what's haggis? Well, haggis is a savoury pudding which contains a lot of sheep, heart, liver, lungs, minced with onions, oatmeal, suet, spices, salt, mixed with stock. You get the idea. And it's all served up in an animal's stomach. Yes, I know. It sounds disgusting. It's actually very nice. And it is the national dish, I guess, of Scotland. So you can imagine that Edinburgh, which is the capital of Scotland, has decided to go vegan in a big way just prior to the Burns Night celebration.
I think I might be vegan for that day, too. That pudding sounds just nasty. I'm sorry. It just sounds nasty.
Well, you say that, Mike, but bear a thought for elderly people in an Edinburgh nursing home, right?
Okay.
People who are in their 70s or 80s, who every single year they're proud Scots, they have celebrated Burns Night, and they look forward to their haggis, which tastes much better than it sounds, trust me. They look forward to their haggis, and then suddenly by edict of the local council, they will not only never eat haggis again, but they will never, ever eat meat again.
Yeah, that requires a boo too. Sorry. I love my meat, grew up on meat. I gotta have my protein, man. I gotta have my steak. I no offense to people who are vegan. I get it, to each their own. But God gave it to us, for a reason. People have been eating meat for years, never hurt them. I believe you got to have the protein. But, hey, listen, that's just me. Don't shoot me.
Well, I think, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, most people's credo is live and let live, right? You want to be vegan, you want to be vegetarian, you want to eat meat, you want to eat nothing but McDonald's. That's fine. You do it. You do whatever you want. Your body, your stomach, whatever your personal taste is when it comes to food. Some people like to eat certain foods that other people don't like. I tend to like most foods, but I know certain people that just can't abide certain types of food and would not dream of ever eating it, be it curries or Chinese food or whatever. That's fine. But the point here is not so much a choice of food as what strikes me as the imposition of a philosophical belief. Now, you might say, well, is vegan a philosophical belief? Well, that was the court ruling from 2020 in the UK. There was a court ruling. Somebody brought this case to court, taking their employers to court. And the whole gist of the case was that his veganism was a philosophical belief system. And the court sided with him. So it's protected under UK law as a belief system. Now, you might say, Kevin, this is all very interesting, but what's this got to do with us? Well, the next bit of the jigsaw that I'm going to give to you is this. Another headline I saw today.
My head is spinning already.
Well, I'm going to preface by saying that G.K. Chesterton said that when someone stops believing in God, they'll believe in anything. And you know our guest is coming up and he doesn't believe in God, and we'll be chatting about that in due course. But recent census in the UK, in particular England and Wales, showed that for the first time, Christianity was a minority religion, right? So for the first time in England and Wales, Christians are in the minority. But before you jump up and say, well, which religion is in the ascendancy? Well, actually, the growing trend is towards ticking a box called no religion. And as many as 37.2% of England and Wales, which is about 22 million people, decided to define themselves as having no religion. But here's the thing. You see, I'm not sure that people not having a religion is not the same as having a belief system. We all have a belief system, as I just demonstrated in Edinburgh. They may be totally anti-religion or have no interest in religion, but they have a belief system. And what they're doing is imposing that belief system on other people, right? Whenever the majority impose their views on the minority, that's an imposition. That's not democracy. That's an imposition. So what I'm saying here is that people may think of themselves as having no religion, but that's not the same as having a belief system. And then the other headline I saw, which made me even more depressed, was this. Now, I'm not going to get into the ding-dong that we've got ongoing between Prince Harry, Meghan Markle, and the royal house here in Britain. I'll leave that up to you. All I will say is that I think that the whole thing, the whole Harry and Meghan affair, demonstrates one thing. Whether you're born in a palace or born in a shack, families are families. Right? Families are families. As I said before, families put the fun in dysfunctional. All families are dysfunctional to some extent, and all we're seeing on a grand scale is a royal family eking out its dysfunction globally. That's not really of any interest to me, or possibly to you either, and it will play on as long as books are being sold and tabloid newspapers are making money out of it. If I were to tell you that it's almost wall-to-wall on talk radio over here, the latest move from Harry, the latest view on Meghan Markle, the latest non-reaction from the palace makes headline news, and somebody somewhere is going to cry enough at one point. I think what's really behind it is that we've had so much bad news with economic downturns, energy problems, cold, road problems, strikes, you name it, we've had it. I think this is just a kind of distracting soap opera for a lot of people, and they're rather enjoying it because it's somebody else's family. It's not your own family you have to deal with, it's the royal family. But anyway, leaving that aside, the headline that depressed me was nothing really to do with this other than this. In Prince Harry's recently published memoir, which I'm not even going to name, but you all know, he revealed that he had gone to see a psychic. Right? Gone to see a psychic. Now, you and I know that these people are, well, I'll come to that in a minute. What depressed me more was the fact that a poll done some years ago by YouGov, which is the main poller in the UK, so the people who do the main, I don't know if there's an US equivalent, but it's the authoritative snapshot of the British public. A poll done about 10 years ago found that around a quarter of British people, so a quarter of a population is roughly between 67 and 70 million people, so a quarter of those had consulted a psychic. Can you believe that? I say it again. When people stop believing in God, they will believe in anything. And it seems to me that the British people are being duped to believe in mediums, clairvoyants, psychics, and all the rest.
We have a psychic reading. There's a psychic reading place, I think, in Robertsdale. Is that correct, Reed? Yeah. Yeah, Reed.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be everywhere. I mean, I passed a hotel not very far from where I'm speaking to you. It's a suburban hotel, and it had a psychic weekend when all weekend there'd be various psychics, in inverted commas, turning up, and you could go along and have your readings done, et cetera, et cetera. And this seemed to be something which even a relatively large hotel thought worthy to have a weekend of this sort of thing. But I mean, we all know, I mean, and the church has been very clear that this clairvoyance and mediums and psychics, a lot of them are fake. A lot of them are fake. And if you don't believe me, have a look at the career of Harry Houdini, the famous escapologist who spent most of his later life debunking fake mediums, fake clairvoyance. He would attend seances and show how the fakery progressed, etc., etc. So there's a long history of debunking these things. But here's the thing. You probably know that there is a medium in the Bible. Let me just ask Dave or Reed. Dave or Reed, do you know where that medium appears?
Yeah, I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in, is Romans in the Bible? I know something about do not believe or and all, it also refers to, there's also a line about, you know, only God knows, you know, the day and the hour, you know, of the end of the world. But there's actually, you know what? I think it may be in the Old Testament. Now that I'm thinking about it, I think it's like maybe in Deuteronomy.
There are many prohibitions against consulting mediums. There are in Leviticus, in Deuteronomy,
I was right about that.
So there's lots of prohibitions against that. Sorcery, it's all linked in with idol worship of one sort or another and wanting to predict the future. But there is a medium who does appear, and that's the Witch of Endor, who you may have heard of. And the Witch of Endor is consulted by Saul, who's the king, the bad king, essentially, whenever David and he fell out, and Saul consults the Witch of Endor and conjures up the spirit of Samuel for consultation. And this is in direct contradiction to what the God's law is, and Saul comes to a bad end. But the church has it's not that we see them all as simply fake, but that we understand that there are some who will have a certain power, a certain foresight into things, and that's the danger. That's the danger, because the question has to be asked, from where does their authority come? From where does their power come? And it doesn't come from God. Okay, let's leave it at that. Now, one of the things, the really sad thing about that article about the British, quarter of the British population, is that a lot of people go to mediums because of grief. They have had a bereavement of some sort, and because they don't believe in anything, what do? They turn to something which allegedly will help them in their grief, something which will help them process that grief, come to terms with it, or allegedly communicate with those that have gone on before. So what this article was basically saying was that a lot of people are being taken advantage of if you imagine that most of these mediums and so forth are fake, then they're not really offering people anything. And remember, all these readings, all these psychic whatevers come at a price. They come at a price. So there's somebody making money out of other people's unhappiness and other people's loneliness post-bereavement. But look, let's leave that aside for one moment. It's rather sad. But there's a rather amusing article that also appeared today, and that's about predictions. Because a lot of people go to mediums and such like because they want to know what's in the future, what's happening in the future. And a researcher did some research on the year 1923 and what was going to happen in 2023. So in 1923, you had a number of newspapers where various correspondents would predict what life would be like today. And the funny thing is that some of these predictions are very, very uncanny. Some of them are totally left field. I mean, always when people are looking into the future, they think we'll be driving around in airplanes instead of cars. So that's the first thing that a lot of them sort of, but we all thought like that. When I was younger, I thought we'd all be driving around in airplanes from place to place. But there's other sort of very interesting things where they talk about almost, some of them have almost anticipated the internet. Yeah,
really?
They talk about, yeah. It's really fascinating. They talk about rapid communication, and it's all based on the new technology, the cutting edge technology of 1923. Now, Micah Reed, do you know what that technology is or was?
Telegrams.
No, telegrams are very 19th century.
Okay. The telephone.
No, telephone was 19th century as well, no. But you're getting close. Something was developed from that scientific exploration, but something was really booming by 1923, really taking off.
Well, you had radio.
That's it.
Yeah.
Broadcast radio. The first U.S. broadcast radio, I think, was 1921. The first station in Detroit started broadcasting. Very quickly, very rapidly, it spread across the United States. It became, you know, into people's homes.
Sure.
People were able to communicate. So there was a lot of predictions based around that. And people even thought, and here's what gave me a laugh, that people would have watches, would be carrying watches where they could pick up radio signals, which isn't a million miles away from the sort of smart watches that Apple have produced, right?
You pretty much can. I mean, it's
yeah.
I mean, you know, I think about like Dick Tracy, the famous comic book, you know, the detective character, and he had the watch and he could call up somebody. Well, that's not, obviously we have that today.
That's exactly what that is.
I mean, pretty much everybody who has a smart watch is a walking Dick Tracy.
I'm sure you
right?
could listen to Archangel Radio on your Apple Watch if you wanted to.
I'm sure many people do. But, you know, interestingly as well, one of the other things about the predictions of the future is that people always suspect or want to imagine that in the future, people will live longer, right? So they imagined that people in the United States would be living to 100 easily, if not 150. That would be normal. But what has happened in the last two decades is that life expectancy in the United States has shrank, gone backwards. And today, the average American lives just 76.4 years. So that prediction was way off. But the other thing they predicted was that most people would be doing 4 hours work a day, that most people would be living a life of ease due to advances in communication and advances in technology. Now, there's some elements where that is becoming
true
in some
truer.
Ways.
People working from home.
But what they didn't predict is that with the advent and the expansion of such technology, that our lives would become so much more busier, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we would end up, you know, being linked in and connected in ways that we never thought possible. But what they also didn't factor in is that the ability to disconnect from that world is getting harder and harder every day.
That's
so,
insane.
Listen, don't worry about predicting the future. Let's live in the present while we can, and let's give thanks for whatever present we are living in. Now, as I say, coming up next is a very interesting man. You're really going to enjoy this interview. Matthew Alper has done all sorts of research and come up with a seminal work entitled The God Part of the Brain. Now, I don't know about you, but when I saw that headline, I thought, this sounds interesting, the God part of the brain. But here's the catch. Matthew may have written the seminal text on this and goes around talking about it, etc., etc. But the quandary is this. Matthew doesn't believe in God. So it's going to be doubly interesting and doubly exciting to chat to him when we come back after this. And remember, if at any point you want to put any questions to Matthew, you can do on 888-928-0881. Or if you prefer me to pose the questions, then by all means, text me on 251-928-2111. Okay. Back after these words, stay with me for the God part of the brain. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency, coming to you live from London this morning. And I am Kevin Turley, your host for the next hour and a half here on Archangel Radio. It's so good to be with you this Thursday morning. And I have a question for you. Is man a spiritual being, immortal, created by God, destined to live as a child of his creator for all eternity? Or is he strictly physical in nature, destined to eternal dust? Well, this is the question which prompted or started a personal odyssey of my next guest. Ever since he was a young child, when he realized one day he was going to die, Matthew Alper set himself out upon a life quest to ascertain whether or not there exists a spiritual reality. Namely, is there a God? After receiving a BA in philosophy, Matthew continued his unconventional journey, working as everything from a photographic assistant in New York City to an electrician in England, I must ask him about that, to a fifth grade and high school history teacher in Brooklyn, a truck smuggler in Central Africa, yeah, I don't know what that is either, and a produced screenwriter in Germany, all the while independently studying the breadth of life sciences from genetics, biology, anthropology, behavioral neuroscience, and much, much more besides. In 1997, he published The Fruit of His Studies and of that stage of his journey, and the book was called The God Part of the Brain, A Scientific Interpretation of Human Spirituality. No, didn't doubtless to say it was of great interest and a great success. And since its initial publication, Matthew has lectured all over the United States and has appeared on national television and national newspapers and numerous radio shows, including Coast to Coast AM, and is an ongoing contributor to the anthology Neurotheology, an emergent new science of which he is considered one of its chief founders. Now, as I said at the start, Matthew is an outspoken member of the atheist and secular humanist movements, and he lives in Brooklyn, where I'm hoping he's speaking to me from this morning. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning. Thanks for the lovely introduction.
Listen, there's so much about your bio I'd love to ask you about, but it sounds like you've had a very interesting life.
Thank you. I believe I have. But yes, I'd rather not get lost in all of that.
No. Well, look, there'll be many people listening this morning, Matthew, who won't have read your book, won't be familiar with your thesis. So could you just sort of set it out for us?
Sure. So basically, you know, it's based in the sciences, in genetics. So I'm just going to give a quick rundown. So according to standard Darwinian science, if there is a physical trait that's universal to any given species, it means it's genetically conceived. So for instance, the fact that all humans have a nose in the middle of their face is not an accident. It's written in our DNA. Mm-hmm. The fact that all cats have whiskers or monarch butterflies have a specific pattern in their wings, again, not an accident. It's because it's written in the DNA. So there's a science called sociobiology that says that the same thing holds true for universal behaviors. It's not an accident that all cats meow and dogs bark and beavers build dams. It's not like every now and then, you know, a dog is born that's building dams and meowing. These are hard truths because it's written in our DNA. So since all behavior is generated from the brain, in the case of cats, for instance, the fact that all cats meow would suggest that somewhere in all cats' brains, there must be a specific region, a series of neural connections responsible for generating that specific behavior, what we could call the meow part of its brain. In the case of humans, every human culture has language, for instance, suggesting that this is not an accident, but it's an inherent part of human nature. We're hardwired with this capacity. And with the help of neuroscience, we know of the Wernicke's area, the Broca's area, the angular gyrus, parts of the human brain that are specific to our language abilities. If you damage one of those parts, get banged in the head or suffer a stroke, you'll suffer what's called a linguistic aphasia, some disability to your capacity to either communicate or comprehend language. So I applied that principle to the fact that every human culture throughout all human history, no matter how isolated, has believed in some form of a spiritual reality, has created their own gods and religion and belief system. So basically suggesting that humans are genetically predisposed, we're hardwired to believe in some form of a transcendental reality. And I write that basically the reason we would have evolved this system in the brain is basically to deal with our unique awareness of death, to help humans. It's basically a coping mechanism that has evolved to help us survive the existential anxiety that comes with our unique understanding of our own mortalities.
Wow, that's a lot to take in.
I know, it's a mouthful. Yeah,
it is. But it's very well put, if I may say, and thank you for that.
Sure.
Let's just unpack that a little bit, because obviously this is a Catholic radio station. I'm coming at it from a slightly different perspective, because when you're saying that we're genetically predisposed to a kind of belief system, that's part of our genetic makeup. What is your understanding of how that comes about? I mean, is it just inherently part of our brain, or is there a way in which that has evolved, or in your studies have you seen a way in which that has shaped or changed or developed over the years?
Well, here's the thing. So when we designate a species, and humans are Homo sapien, so we're a species. From the moment we evolved, which is approximately 200,000 years ago, that our species evolved from a lineage of what were called hominids, a line that goes back to the primates. So once humans evolved, once we came into the mix, basically we've been baked in. It's not like species, when there's a change in a species, it becomes a whole new species. It's designated with a new label. So essentially, human beings have been the same animal for 200,000 years. If we took some infant child from Paleolithic times, like 100,000 years ago, from some, you know, crude Paleolithic nomadic culture, and we're able to take that infant into today's world and raise it by contemporary family, it would be indistinguishable from you and I. So basically, the species has not changed at all. So our awareness and the way we perceive reality has not changed, including the way we perceive these various gods. And essentially, what I suggest is it's not just how we view gods and religion. I essentially apply it to what I call all forms of magical thinking. So it's anything from superstition, good luck, bad luck. These are universals. There's no culture on earth that doesn't have superstitious beliefs, that the concept of luck is a universal. Beliefs in the paranormal, the supernatural, every culture that has believed in various forms of ghosts, because we believe universally in the notion of a spirit. We believe in a spiritual reality, And the point of that belief is so that we can believe that even though we know it's a hard empirical fact that we are all going to die, we have this comforting mechanism in the brain that compels us to believe that even though the physical body will die, this spirit that resides within us will persevere, will live forever. So the fear that we might have that we're inevitably going to lose everyone we love, including ourselves, is sort of, you know, diluted by the fact that we now have this built-in sense that the spirit of those people will live on. And the word spirit is also a universal. In some form, it has existed in every language that has existed on Earth.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Matthew Alper, who's the author of The God Part of the Brain, A Scientific Interpretation of Human Spirituality. To be honest, Matthew, listening to you, though, I'm starting to think the other way. I'm starting to think, well, if this is sort of something which is so much part of the human existence, this belief in something supernatural, something other, and even a desire, a belief, a desire, a hope for an afterlife, if it is so universal and has been with us from the beginning, doesn't it make you think that, well, maybe there's something to it?
Well, there is something to it, because we can recognize which parts of the brain are responsible for these perceptions, but to realize it's perceptual, so, and how relative it is. So, for instance, you know, and I know that these views are antithetical to everything that you probably promote through your radio station, because I'm aware that you're a Christian radio station, but realize that, you know, had you been born, for instance, in times of BC, you wouldn't have even had access to your religion. It wouldn't have existed yet. So you would right now be doing, if radio existed, a radio show promoting Zeus or whatever gods were available based on whatever culture you were born into. So realize that you could say, doesn't it point to something that's real? But then which gods are real? Are they all real? Is Odin and Zeus and Allah and, you know, all of the various belief systems that have existed in every culture, you know, throughout all human history, are they all real? Or is it possible that none of them are? And this is the manifestation of the way that we're wired to perceive reality, to make us a more survivable organism in light of the very, you know, debilitating awareness that humans have, because of our unique awareness of our own mortalities.
But that sort of existential, dread of death is not the only reason why people believe in something, is it?
Well, I think it's the primary thing that prompted the natural selection of the parts of the brain, the mechanics of belief. However, no, it plays a multifaceted role. And in the book, I break it down into two instincts. There's the spiritual instinct and the religious instinct, and they're separate. And from studies, they're finding that they emerge from different parts of the brain. And these things can now be manipulated through chemicals or electrical stimulation, or even, like, I have a chapter in my book called Drug-Induced God, where I talk about how throughout human history, various cultures have used certain plants to induce a religious experience, showing that it's neurochemical in nature. I got this right. What your initial question was?
You were talking about the difference between spiritual and religious. You were just
clarifying. Right. So I was going to say that. So basically, spirituality, the instinct for spirituality, it's a feeling that we have. It's when we meditate and pray, and we have this altered state of consciousness, which is described as a feeling of tranquility, euphoria, a sense of what we call God or cosmic consciousness, a feeling connected to the whole. And that's a feeling that we have that we can stimulate by our behavior, by praying or meditating again, for instance, and it gives us a feeling that there's something bigger that we're connected to. Religiosity is a separate instinct, which basically is more about being part of a group. It's more of a community base. It gives us a sense of community. It gives us our rituals and our customs and basically all of the ideology of our religion. So it gives us our laws and our norms and our customs and our rituals and makes us feel part of a group, gives us a sense of meaning and purpose in life. So yes, it's more than just the existential fear. It provides other you know services for humanity to succeed.
You're listening to Matthew Alper, who's my guest this morning, talking about the God part of the brain, his fascinating 1997 publication, which was a scientific interpretation of human spirituality.
Kevin, real quickly, hey, do you mind if I jump in and ask Matthew a question?
Well, we're just about to go to a break, Mike. So, Matthew, are you okay hanging around for the next segment?
Absolutely. Yep,
Because there's going to be a lot of questions. And listen, if anybody out there has a question for Matthew, 888-928-0881, or text me on 251-928-2111. We're investigating the connections between brains and belief. Stay with me here on Archangel Radio.
Shame on you. Change your heart. Look around you. Change your heart.
Welcome back to Turley Frequency, live and exclusive here on Archangel Radio. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Matthew Alper, all the way from Brooklyn in New York City, who is the author of The God Part of the Brain. And Matthew, just listening to you, and there's a number of questions already coming in, so I'm gonna field them to you in a moment, if that's okay. But I've got a question, really. When I was listening to you, and obviously we're fundamentally different in our beliefs in some ways, but, you know, I'm sort of fascinated by somebody like you who doesn't believe, right? Who's an atheist. Mm-hmm. I think that's correct mm-hmm. way of describing you as an atheist. Because I'm thinking, you know, I'm not an atheist. I'm very happily as a Christian. And I just wonder, you know, is your life as happy as mine is?
Well, you know, until they create a device called a, you know, happyometer, I guess it'll be hard to compare. But I think that regardless, look, first of all, I believe that nature, biology, instilled this in us for a reason to a certain extent, one could say, make us happier, sort of pull us away from the darkness of impending death. So there's a reason that people believe. I believe it's a human instinct. It's why religions have emerged in every single culture. You know, but happiness is such a subjective and, you know, sort of hard to put your finger on. I mean, you know, one could be an atheist or a believer and in either circumstance, let's say, be in an unhappy marriage. Or have a child with some horrible illness, you know. Totally. So I mean, you know, again, it's a very difficult thing to put your finger on. Now you might have a certain community in your belief that I might not have. I mean, you know, certainly I guess there are atheist get-togethers, but it's not as consistent as believing in any version of a religion. Because religions are, you know, very developed institutions, and they that is again one of the reasons why we evolved this, to give us a sense of belonging, to give us a community and a feeling of belonging to something through having rituals and common norms and beliefs and values, etc. But
I probably phrased it pretty badly, Matthew. But at the end of the day,
no, you didn't phrase it poorly. I understand the question. It was a legitimate question. Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, I see death as a gateway to something better, whereas I'm taking it that you see death as just the end.
I see death as just the end. But right now in this lifetime, we can look at this in different ways. So, for instance, you have the comfort of feeling that there's something awaiting you, whereas I feel like I've got a clock ticking. And you just read my resume, and you, as you said, I've lived an interesting life. So I've been partly compelled to try to live as interesting a life as possible, you know, and to do as much as possible and learn as much as possible and experience as much as possible, because I feel like, you know, there's a time limit. Now, if you're wrong, you know, one could say a person of belief may have squandered their life because they're waiting for the next one to come. And if, you know, if I'm wrong, then I've still got something else awaiting me. But if I'm right, I could say, well, I'm glad then that I pushed myself to really try to experience as much as possible. So, you know, it's just two life views as far as whether we can measure the happiness of either one of those. That's hard to say.
Yeah. I take your point. But I mean, it's funny you say that, because my view of life is probably very similar to yours, in the sense that I've got to wring the great joy, happiness, and anything else I can find out of it. But it's in the light that my time is short, that there's a purpose to it. There's a meaning to it. But anyway, let me just throw some of these questions at you, if I may, Matthew. There's somebody who's texted in and said, please ask Matthew how the physical part of this fits into what he's saying. And by physical, I mean people seeing spirits and hearing spirits and being talked to by spirits, seeing people that have died and those kind of things. I hope that's clear.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So, again, because I'm suggesting that there are parts of the brain that compel us to have these beliefs, it makes sense that people have visions of things that don't exist. It's kind of like phantom limbs. You know, a soldier loses his arm in a battle. He feels his arm moving around because the brain is wired to perceive that. It's not real, but it's in his mind, as a perception, it is. So if I apply that question to the fact, for instance, that if I go to different cultures, they're going to have different visions. So if I go to India, for instance, and I interview 100 people, and let's say half of them say, oh, yeah, I have visions all the time. Their visions are going to be of Ganesh and all of the various gods in their pantheon. And, the visions that a Christian might have might be like where they saw some vision of Jesus or Mother Mary. So, again, the visions themselves are relative. So unless everyone's visions are real, meaning all of the gods are real, it either comes down to that all of the visions are real or perhaps none of them are.
You're listening to Matthew Alper, who's my guest this morning, and Matthew is the author of The God Part of the Brain. Matthew, if I could just let one of our producers, Mike, come in here. Mike, I think you've got a question for Matthew.
Yeah, first of all, Matthew, thank you so very much for being our guest. This is an excellent conversation we're having. I'm so entrenched in it. So, again, I cannot thank you enough. This is fantastic.
Well, thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Great radio. My question is, how do you believe that man, or the species, came about into existence? And my second question is, I'm gonna get it for a second here. This is a friend that is asking this. How does an atheist answer the original question of the ancient Greek philosophers? Why is there something rather than nothing? So the first question, you know, how did the species come about?
You know? Right. So the first question, you know, I mean, basically from my perspective now, you know, if you guys are creationists and believe that God sort of put everything here in 7 days, you know, that's one version. But according to, you know, the scientific explanation, as you know, it defers to evolutionary theory. So if you're asking someone like me or any scientist or any academic, how did we get here? Then I would just, you know, talk us through, as I kind of alluded to earlier, the evolution of the hominid line, which was basically a 12 million year lineage between primates and Homo sapiens. So basically we went from, you know, primates, started standing upright, losing our hair. But as we know genetically, we're like 99.8% our genetics are similar to the primates. So, you know, again, it's just a, it's a 12 million year lineage that goes through, you know, Australopithecus and all of these versions of humanity. And that would be the scientific explanation of how we, as in Homo sapiens, got here. It's not like we didn't fall from a meteorite or anything. It was a long process of basically 3.8 billion years of natural selection from single-celled organisms leading to us.
But how did those single-celled organisms come about? I mean, how did those 12 billion years ago, how do we get – I guess that kind of harkens back to the question about the Greek philosophers, which said, you know, why is there something rather than nothing?
Sure. That's a different question. So, first of all, the 12 million years is the hominid line. 12 million years ago, we stemmed from primates. If we're talking about how did the first single-celled molecules evolve, now we're talking about not 12 million years, but 3.8 billion years is the origin of Earth. And that's something that's being explored. Essentially, there's something called the heterotroph hypothesis, where they've tried to recreate basically the original soup, what was brewing in the oceans, using like a mix of ammonia and carbon and oxygen and nitrogen, and sort of, and then boiling it because the seas were boiling, and then exposing it to electricity because there were electrical storms. And what they find is when you mix this brew, you end up with amino acids forming, complex molecules that were basically the predecessors to all life, to all living things. So essentially, it's like a chemistry set, you know. So, you know, as far as will we ever have a – and it's something that the scientific community is ever getting closer to trying to understand the origin of the first living molecules that were able to basically replicate themselves and give birth to a copy of themselves, which is the beginning of reproduction, which was then the beginning of life, being these material genetics being passed from one generation to the next. So that actually can be explained to a large extent. As far as the Greek question, going back to that, mm-hmm. you know, why is there anything? So, you know, that's an unanswerable. You know, basically, you know, it's part of human nature to look for causes. So it's in our nature to say why and from where and from whence did anything come? Did anything emerge? So essentially, it's just, to me, I look at it as just like, I call it nature. Whatever it is, however it got here, it is, it's nature. The bigger question is there a conscious entity that is sort of the supervisor, you know, managing reality, managing nature, sort of pushing nature in certain directions, having a say in nature? My take would be no, that these are just physical realities unfolding based on the physical forces of nature, as opposed to a conscious entity, which I believe is just the subject of anthropomorphizing, humans projecting our own sense of what reality is onto the cosmos and saying there must be some divine creator behind all of this, because otherwise, how did it get here? And again, I think that that's part of the mechanics of the way the human brain has manifested itself. Because if we go back prior to humanity, prior to Homo sapien, there were no spiritual animals. There was, mm-hmm. you know, there was no God. There was no belief system in spiritual realities. So essentially, it's a new concept that has only been, you know, a reality on Earth or perhaps in the entire universe for like the last 200,000 years since almost the inception of our species.
You're listening to Matthew Alper, who's the author of The God Part of the Brain, A Scientific Interpretation of Human Spirituality and God. Thank you for that question, Mike, and thank you for the anonymous text that was sent in, and thank you, Matthew, for reading it. Matthew, let me ask you this. You're a convinced atheist. Do you ever have the Christian equivalent of a dark night of the soul? Do you ever doubt your own certainty in this matter?
You know, I'm a proponent of science. I mean, there's so much, you know, right here as we're speaking on the phone, you're in London. We have technologies now that connect us. I have, you know, I have What I have faith in is that if I flip the switch on my wall, a light's going to go on. And that's all, those are all the fruits of science. So the fruits of belief haven't really produced anything other than belief. The fruits of science have given me substance, have given me cause to believe, because I've seen the fruits of it. We're talking through one right now. So for me, the hard evidence, the support, basically a belief is a belief until there's hard evidence, in which case it becomes knowledge, it becomes a fact. That's the way a scientist views the world. You know, when a belief can be justified with physical evidence, it becomes a fact. It's no longer a belief. So for me, when I read a science book, I'm reading a compendium of facts, not suppositions or beliefs or I felt this thing, so it must be real.
But surely, Matthew, so much of human life is about things which are not factual. I mean, love and other emotions, you know, they're not things that we can say are factual. They're just emotions, or they're aspects of human existence.
Okay, well, again, a neuroscientist would disagree with you. Love can be measured. Love, really, there are parts of our brain that give us the capacity for love. It's in the limbic system where all emotions are generated. There are people who get banged in the head or suffer from some disease where there's degeneration to those parts of the brain, and those people can't feel love. And some people are born genetically with predispositions where, for instance, they're born towards sociopathy. They will never be able to experience love. They don't know what it is. They manufacture some version of it, but it's all about manipulating people. But they can experience love the way you might feel it. And everyone feels it differently, but all of these things can be measured in the brain. And they can also be manipulated by chemistry or electric impulse through the brain. So these are actually hard facts. We feel like they're ethereal entities because we feel them. But as we're feeling things, as we're feeling love, if they put you in a brain scan, they could identify exactly where that feeling's coming from. And if they clip that part of your brain out, you would no longer be able to have those feelings.
Matthew, thank you so much for coming on today. Can you tell people where they could find out more about you and your book?
Sure. Well, they can go to the website, which is www.godpart.com, as in the God part of the brain, or they can go to Amazon and order the book. It's available worldwide.
That's great. Thank you so much for coming on, Matthew. That was Matthew Alper and the God part of the brain. When we come back, we will be taking the prayer part of the brain and praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet back after these words.